Check one, two, check, check. This mic is very loud. All right. What park are we at?
We are at Woodland Park.
And what are you doing, Gabriel?
Well, right now, let's see if you can tell. I am just doing what people do at the park, or some people, anyway. I don't usually do this. I'm on a swing. I have long been wondering about something. As a father of two little kids, little kids can swing for an hour and not get tired of it one bit. And I was like, oh, okay, this looks like fun. I think I'd like to try that. So I tried it as a father in his 30s. And I was shocked to discover that I felt like I was going to throw up within about half a minute. And I thought to myself, what has changed? Like, am I just that old and crusty? And that really got me wondering what happens in our bodies, in our minds, as we get older, that makes us so quintessentially adult or childlike. So what I thought we'd do is investigate that today on Sound Effect here on KPLU. And before we do that, Arwin,
oh, no.
You're my producer, my friend. It's time for you to give this a try. Now,
this is not fun.
Well, okay, explain to me how you're feeling about getting on the swing.
So I hate swings because I'm terrified of them, because they make me nauseous immediately, but more than making me nauseous, they make me feel like a grown-up baby. And I honestly feel like I'm going to cry just thinking about it because I hate it so much.
What's going through your mind right now? So you are standing adjacent to the swing. You haven't been able to actually sit down in it yet. I'm going to invite you to go ahead and try and do that.
Okay. All right. What do you want from me here, Gabriel?
I just want to know. I see your eyes are a little
wide.
Are you really feeling super? I mean, what are you afraid of?
It's not even the fear. It puts knots in my stomach, and it makes my blood feel like it's flowing in the wrong direction. But more than anything, I just feel like I'm doing life wrong because of how much I hate the swings, because everyone else seems to love it so much.
So you say everyone loves it, but not everyone. Mostly kids.
Yeah.
What do you think when you see a kid swinging away contentedly?
Like, I don't get it. Like, I don't understand what's so fun, but I think that there's, like, this... Maybe children are just able to, like, suspend this fear. Like, they're not thinking about going over the bar of the swing or falling off the swing or any of those things. And I always thought about that as a little kid.
I don't know if you're a grown-up baby so much as you were a baby grown-up.
Maybe I was a baby grown-up. Maybe I was just too self-aware and, like, now I have the level of anxiety that makes me really good at public radio and not much else.
So today on Sound Effect, we're going to investigate the gap between grown-up baby and baby grown-up, our show about ages and aging, as soon as Arwin does her very best to take one good swing.
Oh, God, it's awful. It's so bad. Okay, no, I'm done. It's not good. I don't like it. Makes my knees weak.
Before we start really feeling our age today, we're going to be taking a few minutes to catch up on the news of the week with some really smart reporters. They include Emily Parkhurst. She's the digital managing editor at Puget Sound Business Journal. Peter Robison is Seattle bureau chief at Bloomberg News. And Joanne Lasoski teaches communications and journalism at Pacific Lutheran University. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Sound Effect.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. Well, we're going to talk in a minute about our choices for underreported and overreported stories of the week. But we're going to take a moment to talk about this week's top story, which we've decided is transportation this week, mostly jumping off from the big transportation package, multi-billion-dollar package passed by the state Senate, first one in decades. But there's also other stuff, too. Mayor Ed Murray in Seattle gave his 10-year vision for transportation here in the city. And there's even movement, if you'll excuse the pun, on a bathroom czar for Metro drivers. So we're going to get into all that stuff as well. So, Emily, maybe we could start with you about this transportation bill that the state Senate passed. What are the stakes of this thing? Why is it such a big deal
to get a transportation package through?
You know, I think right now the issue is recruiting. Particularly in Seattle, you've got this enormous growth of the tech industry here, you know, driven mostly by Amazon, but there are a number of other tech companies here that are hiring hundreds, in some cases thousands of people a year. And in order to bring in that number of people, you need to be able to recruit them, and you need to have a system where they can get to work, and it's not going to be a really intrusive part of their lives. And people do look at that when they consider their options and where they're going to live.
So getting around the Seattle area, definitely a big part of this, but there's projects all over the state, projects in South Sound, projects in Eastern Washington as well, that are going to get some of this money. And Peter Robison, what kind of a feat was it to get a package through the Senate at all?
I think it's been close to 2 years that the package has been deadlocked, and it's because of the split control in Olympia. And the bill that the Senate came up with is really laden with a lot of measures that would make you wonder if it'll pass at all. It's got the poison pill that would make it hard to implement the low carbon fuel standards. It takes money from education. So although it was progress to get it passed, it's not clear if this is going to be the final result.
Explain what that poison pill is.
It's a measure that would essentially obliterate the transit funding if anything like the low carbon fuel standards are implemented over the next 16 years, the period that this package covers.
So that's a big priority for Governor Inslee. And this says if that goes through, then a bunch of the money that would go into multimodal transit will get plowed into more traditional sort of roads and bridges kind of stuff.
Exactly.
So, Joanne Lozowski, you call this a Gordian knot. What do you mean by it?
Well, it just seems like it's going to slow everything down, literally. Because if it does pass, then the carbon emissions, we can't even talk about carbon emissions for 16 years. That's what it sounds like. It's like no discussion about it whatsoever. It seems like that might slow it down. There's some Democrats there that are going to say, wait a minute, can we say 10 years? Can we say 9 years?
Is Maybe. It conceivable that the Democratic House and the Democratic governor would let it go through with that provision?
I mean, just from my perspective, it seems like that might be something to hold the whole thing up. That's why I said it was a Gordian knot, getting stuck in the throat of the governor.
Yeah. And the other issue is the ports. It's important, right, as Emily said, to move people around, but it's also getting harder and harder to move goods around. And ports in British Columbia are taking market share from Tacoma and Seattle because it's getting so hard to compete with their efficient multimodal transport.
I don't know that it's entirely, though, the question of the ports. It's also the slowdown that happened for the past, you know, 3 or 4 months really had an impact on driving cargo traffic up to BC, but also down to Mexico and down through the Panama Canal. Now that that's being widened, that's a real risk for our ports here.
So we'll be watching this carefully to see where this winds up in the state house. And of course, if and when it gets to the governor's desk, what happens there. That's our top story this week, the big transportation package out of the Senate and transportation in general here in the state of Washington. Now we're going to move into our nominees for overreported story of the week and underreported story of the week. And Emily Parkhurst, maybe you could kick it off for us. What is a story that you've had about enough of that you would just as soon see retired, or at least tamped down, shall we say?
You know, I think a lot of news organizations, including the one that I work for, covered the King 5 move out of South Lake Union and down to the Soto neighborhood pretty extensively this week. And I think it's a really interesting story. But there's a larger story there that I think is also really important. And that is really that the office space in South Lake Union is going at a premium. It is really expensive right now. And I think we're going to see more and more of the businesses that were there for years, like King 5, that were there for 63 years, I believe, looking for office space elsewhere and selling off their buildings if they own them because they're so incredibly valuable in South Lake Union right now. And I think that that's actually going to be a big boom for Soto. So there's kind of a larger story there that wasn't told maybe as frequently or as well as it should have been, and I think it's a really important one for Seattle.
All right. Well, thanks for that overreported story, Emily Parkhurst. Joanne Lozowski, you have a nominee for overreported?
Well, the one is that I have that's sort of connected to the transportation issue started with the idea that the metro bus cost was going to go up for some people and down for others. But attached to that story, they also included the comfort station supervisor job that was paying almost $100,000. $100,000 to be a poop czar. It sounded like some. It was certainly an attractive job to me.
Well, in case you haven't caught up on this one, what does one do in a comfort station?
So the comfort stations are apparently would go into different businesses, and they actually had made some kind of a contract with the YWCA or YMCA. To allow the drivers to park the bus, jump out for a minute, and come back in again. And the comfort station supervisor would be going along the routes and asking other businesses, could our drivers possibly come in just for a second?
So you have to be a salesman, I would guess.
Yes, I could do that.
All right, so the bathrooms are an overreported story, according to Joanne Lisowski. How about you, Peter Robison? What's your nominee?
Well, I'm tired of hearing about pot. The twists and turns of medical marijuana legislation and the black market. It's an important issue. We need to watch, you know, the societal changes. But I don't need a story every day about it. Let's come back to it when we have a chance.
So, marijuana, overreported story. Peter Robison, you have an underreported story?
I do. There was a forum this week on Capitol Hill about anti-gay violence, and I just find it stunning that in Seattle in 2015, this is something we're talking about. And one of the things that came out of the forum was an idea to have a nighttime shuttle to get lesbian gay people home from Pike Pine. And if you've been in Seattle for a while, it has shades of the Q Patrol in the 90s that had berets and combat boots and modeled themselves after the guardian angels. And I just find it stunning that this is happening right now. And it's also tied up with the gentrification and development in Capitol Hill, which is changing the neighborhood quite a lot.
And is there a statistical increase in hate crimes on Capitol Hill or in the city overall that we know of?
It has gone up, but the numbers are not big enough to draw conclusions. And there is a police argument that there may just be a change in awareness rather than an increase in the reported incidents.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and we are going over the week's overreported and underreported stories with our three guests, Emily Parkhurst of Puget Sound Business Journal, Peter Robison of Bloomberg News, and Joanne Lisowski of the Department of Communications at Pacific Lutheran University. Emily Parkhurst, what is your choice for underreported story?
You know, I think what the one of the more underreported business stories in Seattle right now is the possible move by Expedia outside of Bellevue. And if Expedia leaves Bellevue, that's going to be a huge hit for the downtown corridor. You know, obviously they have their tower right there in downtown Bellevue, and that's a real flagship business for downtown Bellevue. It's been there for years, and it's a really important business for them. It's also got, you know, ties to Microsoft. Expedia spun out of Microsoft years and years ago. And so to lose Expedia from the east side would be a really, really big loss for that entire area. And they're talking, apparently, about moving to Seattle. And we have spoken to their CFO, who has confirmed that they are considering leaving Bellevue, but they have no intention of leaving the Puget Sound region. So the implication there is that they're looking at Seattle. One of the things that we have heard is that they're considering the Amgen campus, which is about the size that they're looking for. I think it's 750,000 square feet. And that's about the size that they're looking for their entire campus.
Well, thanks for drawing our attention to it. Joanne Lisowski, what is your underreported story?
I know that I thought it was surprising we didn't get that much information about SHB 1068, a bill that passed the House on March 2nd that mandates that rape kits must be tested. It mandates that something that police do routinely during rapes or during accusations of rape, that they have to test them. They don't just get to collect them.
So the idea is that these things get collected and then they just sit somewhere?
I think there's recent reporting across the country that there are thousands of these rape kits in different police stations across the country that have never been tested.
And what is a rape kit exactly?
Emily's much more attuned in this.
So I was a volunteer advocate for many years for a sexual assault center in another state, and it's a very long process. It takes between 5 and 7 hours in some cases to collect this evidence. It's incredibly invasive for the victim, and it really is a very serious evidence collection. So it's a program that has a certain cost associated with it. They collect these, and then in a lot of cases, tens of thousands of them just sit, and they're never tested. The DNA is never tested. And, you know, in some cases, it's because the victim
chooses not to.
But in a lot of cases, that's not always true.
Wow. And it's amazing to think of putting a victim through such an invasive and lengthy process and then doing nothing with it in some cases.
And it's not just in our state that this is happening, but we have put forward a bill at this point to try to mandate that something gets done about it.
Well, the bill mandating the processing of rape kits, that's Joanne Lisowski's nominee for Underreported Story of the Week. Well, I want to thank all of you for joining us today talking over the news. Emily Parkhurst is Digital Managing Editor at Puget Sound Business Journal. Peter Robison heads up the Seattle Bureau for Bloomberg News, and Joanne Lisowski teaches communications at Pacific Lutheran University. Thanks so much for being on Sound Effect.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, you're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're talking about age, aging, the beauty, the perils, a little bit of everything. And I'm here with Dr. Dan Gotchling, who heads the Gotchling Lab at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. Hey, Dr. Gotchling, thanks for coming on Sound Effect.
My pleasure, Gabriel.
So, what is aging?
It's one of those things that you know it when you see it, but in a more specific sense, one of the views we have is that it's when cells or an organism can't take insults as well as it did before.
So wait, when you say that, they wouldn't have as good a time at a Don Rickles show? Or what do you mean by take an insult?
Senior people might have a better time, but what I mean,
yeah, right.
But what I do mean is that insults from the outside, so let's say damage or challenges that might change the capacity of the cell to function normally or the organism. So for instance, if you got a cut, when you're young, you heal very quickly. When you're my age, it takes quite a few more days than a five-year-old does.
What are the big open questions about it on a cellular level that you are wrestling with in your lab?
One of the biggest issues is both defining it. So the question you're asking us is one we're wrestling with all the time. What is breaking down or unable to deal with an insult anymore? And then the second part is it turns out that everything is interconnected, you know, whether it's organs in our body that are talking to each other, our brain talks to our muscles, et cetera. That also happens at the cellular level. So all these things like your chromosomes and your mitochondria, they all are talking to each other. And what we're trying to figure out is that if one of them goes down the tubes, if you think about this as a big spider web, and it pulls on the web, it starts to pull down the other parts of the web as well. And so that has a big problem for the cell. And we're trying to understand, one, how the network or web is connected, and two, where the weak links are to cause it to collapse.
One of the things I've never completely understood is that if your cells are constantly dividing and renewing themselves, and we hear sometimes, you know, that every so many years your body is completely different than it was the few years before, then my cells are being reborn all the time. Why are they getting older? Why don't I just live forever?
It turns out that there's something which we call asymmetry. That is, there are things we call stem cells that continue to divide, and they give off those new cells that you see. As a result of that continual dividing by that one stem cell, and in the organism I call it, we call it the mother cell, she only has the capacity to divide a finite number of times. And so while most of your cells are indeed sloughing off, it's because of the daughter cells that she's giving off that you see.
So she's getting tired.
That's right.
When does the decline in our bodies start? I mean, does it start at birth?
My view is that after about the age of 35, things start going down the tubes.
So that's where the hill, after which you are over the hill, it's somewhere around 35?
Yeah, 35, 40 years old. Yeah.
I am totally on the wrong end of that, though. That seems pretty young. Why is that the, is that kind of the sweet spot then? Is that the best age?
When I was there, yes, it was. I'll give you sort of an evolutionary biology perspective. So in biology, we have this thing called the biological imperative. It's to continue to propagate the species. No matter whether you're a bacteria or a human, you want to continue to have your species go forward. In humans, it turns out that we evolved to live to about the age of 35. And the idea is simply that we try to be old enough to have kids. For us humans, that's in our teenage years. And then the way our species evolved, we have to be able to get our offspring up to that age as well. We have to protect them until they're of that age. And so basically you take teenagers, double the number, and that's kind of where that sweet spot is. And there has been what we call no longer any selection for living beyond that age.
So evolution doesn't really care about you after that.
That's right.
After you're 35, 36.
That's right.
So much in science and culture is about extending life and quality of life beyond that point. Mm-hmm. Are there trade-offs for doing that?
Yes, there are. And I think we're seeing that in our society already. So if you just do epidemiology or statistics on what happens in people we know that since we've been doing it for however many hundreds of years, it turns out that after the age of 35 or 40, all the diseases that our modern society care about start to come out. So heart disease, cancer, Alzheimer's, etc. In one sense, our society and we humans are in this big experiment right now. Because only about a few hundred years ago, if you will, or depending on how you want to start the numbers, or 1,000 years ago, did we have the capacity to have protection from the environment, have regular food, and those were the big things. Only in the last 100 years or so have we been able to protect ourselves against the next big thing, and that was infections.
So really only like relatively healthy, well-off people are around long enough to get sick.
That's right.
And is that behind...
To get old. Yeah.
To get old.
Yeah, right.
And getting old also means getting sick, right?
Yeah.
So many of those diseases that you just mentioned are in some ways side effects of a longer lifespan and having our basic needs met?
Yes, I would say that's true.
So you're a basic scientist. You're trying to understand how these things work on the most fundamental levels. Is, you know, what is driving that? I mean, are you out to find the fountain of youth?
No, actually, I'm not. For me, it's more a basic curiosity as to how systems break down. It's very analogous, for me at least, to the computer industry. There's all these complicated processes going on, and you can have your computer running just fine for days nowadays, or weeks. But then every once in a while, there'll be a glitch. And once that glitch happens, it starts to take things down such that you can't restart your computer or whatever. And so what I'm very curious is, why do things break down, in essence, with time?
Has this work and what you have learned changed the way you think about it in your own life?
A little bit, in the sense that I'm beginning to appreciate sort of that interconnectivity I was telling you about, how everything touches everything else, and also about what I should and shouldn't eat. So I have to admit, I don't eat as many candy bars as I used to, though I still do have a sweet tooth, as anyone who knows me will attest to.
So a little bit less sugar, but not an existential crisis necessarily?
Right, exactly.
Well, Dr. Dan Gotchling heads up the Gotchling Lab at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, where he studies the basic processes of aging. Thank you so much for joining us on Sound Effect.
Thank you, Gabriel.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. Gabriel Spitzer here, and we're talking about age today and getting older. And I'm joined now by senior producer Arwen Nix. Hey, Arwen.
Hi, Gabriel.
Are you feeling fully recovered from your swing trauma?
No, not fully, but I'm here.
Okay. Well, we're going to try and get to the bottom of this question that I had, which is namely that after I had kids, I discovered that little kids can swing endlessly and enjoy themselves the entire time. And I thought, well, geez, I should give this a try, too. I remember liking swinging when I was a kid. And so I had occasion to actually sit on a swing and try it and discovered I can do it for about 30 seconds before I feel like I'm going to throw up.
Yeah, I'm with you. I hate it.
So, yeah, I wanted to know, I mean, are we weird or are there more out there like us? So I started talking to other parents on the playground, and I asked them how long their kids like to go on the swings.
Oh, they can go by 20 minutes from now.
Probably 15 minutes if someone's there, and we'll give him underdogs.
She could go probably a half hour if she wants.
Mom gets tired of it much sooner than they do. They could sit on this, I don't even know how long.
Sometimes it feels like hours if you're pushing.
Forever. He never gets tired of it.
That is awful.
Only you would say that. Well, I know what you mean, though. So I started to ask these parents if they themselves had had a chance to try out the swings lately and how that experience went.
Not as fun as I remember it being when I was his age.
How long before you were like, okay, I've had enough?
A solid minute.
After I had a child, it's like, whoa, I can't do these anymore.
I do get a little dizzy sometimes.
Suddenly the swings make you a lot more sick than they used to. All this play equipment, like these spinny things, oh, it makes me want to vomit.
Have you tried it out?
Yeah, same thing. I get really dizzy.
Yeah. You got dizzy, and how long could you stand it before you had to get off?
Like 10 seconds, if that.
So I should say that not everybody had this reaction. Some people liked the swings just fine. I even saw one actual adult swinging voluntarily. But most, I would say the majority at least, reacted the way that you and I did.
So it seems like most of the people have some sort of change. I myself have always had an aversion to the swings. I would much rather be in the library than on the playground. But is it that something for the rest of you changes?
Well, that is what I wanted to know. You know, what changes as you get older? And specifically, I was figuring, you know, maybe it's something in your inner ear, which is where your vestibular system is, the thing that helps you balance. I thought maybe something changes in there that makes you less able to tolerate this kind of motion that you get on swings. So I wanted to know what happened scientifically. And I called this guy Bernie Cohen, who is an expert on balance disorders and motion sickness at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York. And in our conversation, I was a little surprised to learn that, first off, it's probably not something physical. It's probably something more neurological, because kids are born with really excellent vestibular systems that don't change all that much. And secondly, that the science has not really figured this out yet.
If you look to see what the scientific basis for it is, it's not there. And I think that the reason may be it's very difficult to do those kinds of experiments with children. I mean, parents don't want to, you know, subject their kids to motion sickness.
Yes, indeed. What kind of monster would subject their child to such merciless experimentation with motion sickness?
Who are you?
I'm Oliver.
How old are you?
4.
How do you know me?
Because you were my daddy.
So I took Oliver to the Balance and Dizziness Center at the University of Washington Medical Center to subject him and me to a few tests.
So wait, does Oliver even like to swing?
Oh, yeah, totally. He loves to swing. He loves to spin around in office chairs until he feels sick. He loves to go on the merry-go-round. He likes to be tickled until he pees. He loves all that stuff.
So what are these tests like? What was he doing?
Okay, so there's a handful of them. And we only did a few of them, but one was actually a pretty good simulation of a spinning office chair. It was basically a chair that spins you around in a darkened booth. One really cool one was you lay down on a hospital bed, and they blow warm and cold air in your ears. And doing that makes you feel like you're spinning. And in fact, it can make you really disoriented. But the one that we spent the most time on was this one particular little chamber of horrors.
The test is called computerized dynamic posturography.
That looks pretty cool. So basically, it's a sort of three-walled phone booth with a platform that you stand on. And what happens? I'm guessing that thing shakes you around a little bit.
Yeah, that's right. So the floor can move, the walls can move, and your job is not to move.
Now, if you have like a vestibular disorder, if your sense of balance is clinically impaired, this can really throw you for a loop. So there's actually a harness to keep you from falling down.
Clip into these guys?
Yeah.
So clipping in with carabiners too. Some straps that are suspended from the ceiling.
So wait, is this you getting strapped in or is Oliver getting strapped in?
We both did this one, but this is me. I went first.
The first instruction is to stand quietly with your eyes open.
So I'm standing there and I start to feel kind of woozy, like as if you had just a few drinks and you're not sure whether the ground is moving or not.
Was something happening?
Actually, no.
Okay, good.
You were but we were measuring.
Does anyone ever like fall over during that part?
Some people do.
The power of suggestion is strong. So you go through like a series of trials with slightly different instructions. There's one where just what you see changes. There's another one where the platform you're standing on moves around. you know, sometimes you're doing this with your eyes open, sometimes you're doing it with your eyes closed. And in another one, when you, the way you push back with your feet on the platform actually moves the entire booth around.
I'm, you're doing such a good job of describing so many different nightmare scenarios to me. But how did Oliver do at these tests?
All right, here, Ollie, here's what we're going to do. Ollie did pretty good. We're going to wear this like a vest. There you go.
This feels kind of heavy.
He liked how the inside walls of this little chamber were painted to look kind of like this mountain and lake landscape scene.
Well, it looks like another planet.
All right, are you ready to try?
Okay.
Dr. Phillips had warned me that little kids in this particular test tend to be a little bit unsteady, but Oliver was actually pretty solid.
It felt like the floor was moving a lot.
Feel a little wobbly?
Yeah.
Was it scary or anything?
It didn't feel scary.
These tests all generate computer data, and Professor Phillips said Oliver and I both did really well.
Okay, so I'm proud of you. You both have good functioning inner ears, but what about the original question? Why are kids so much better on swings than adults are?
Okay, so that is how I saw this question going into this, that kids are better at something and that we lose this skill with age somehow. And I found out that's actually only partly true, and it's also kind of the opposite. So what this test illustrates is that balance isn't only what comes from your inner ear. Your brain is getting information from your inner ear, but it's also getting information from your eyes, from your ankles, and then it takes all that data and it stirs in some understanding of how matter and gravity work, and then it runs it through this little algorithm in your brain that gives you a sense of balance. And that's why you don't fall over when you're standing on the bus and it goes around a corner. And that is where kids are not as good as adults.
We have lots of expectations about the nature of the world and how that sensory information combines with information from our eyes and from our ankles, whereas kids don't. They have kind of more of an open mind.
So because they don't have as much information or as much experience, they can actually deal with it better when it gets all unstable?
I think in some situations they can do better. The conflict that we sense, they're less sensitive to.
So yeah, because kids aren't as good as understanding how the world is supposed to work, then they're more resilient when things don't work like they're supposed to, when things go off kilter, like when the world is going up and down and forward and backward when you're on a swing.
So what you're telling me is that I'm either completely underdeveloped and always have been, or I was wildly ahead of my time and that change just happened so much sooner for me, and that's why I've always hated swings.
I'm pretty sure it's the second one. And here's the thing that should make you feel a little bit better about this. The vestibular system is actually one of the most flexible parts of our brain that there is. Even well into adulthood, they call it very plastic. You know, it's adaptable. So you can train yourself. And that's why astronauts and figure skaters can go to work without, you know, vomiting all over the cockpit or all over the ice or whatever. So what that means is that all it takes is some kind of, you know, regular training regimen on the playground, you and me, 5 a.m. at the swing set. You in?
I am not in. I am not.
Hey, thanks, Arwen.
You're welcome, Gabe.
Arwen's going to be back in just a few minutes here on Sound Effect to explain to us why you'd leave behind a perfectly good stripping career in order to take a job in accounting, and then why you'd come back to burlesque in your 60s. That's coming up on Sound Effect right here on KPLU in just a few minutes. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and you're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU, and today we are exploring aging. So sometimes you follow a story, and sometimes the story follows you. So those of you who are regular listeners to Sound Effect, you might remember that in one of our first shows, we had this segment on an activist whose name was Susan Stern. She was a member of the Weatherman and the Seattle Liberation Front, and she was also a really interesting figure, a writer, a feminist, and for a while, an exotic dancer at a downtown strip club. After we aired that segment, we learned that the manager of that strip club for a short period of time in the late 1970s was KPLU's very own Nick Morrison. And he spun some tales about the New Paris Follies in the episode that we had about Vice. Now, another chapter of this story has found us, and joining me to explain it is Sound Effect senior producer Arwen Nix. Hey, Arwen.
Hi, Gabriel. So after we aired the story with Nick, about his time managing the Striptease Theater downtown, we got this call from a listener.
I was listening to the program, and it comes up that Nick used to be the manager of the Paris Follies in downtown Seattle on 2nd and James. And he started mentioning some of the names of the gals that he worked with. And all of a sudden, he says, Eartha Quake and her daughter, Cup. And I went, oh my God, that's me.
So that is Eartha Quake, a.k.a. Michelle Mulholland. And she used to work with Nick Morrison downtown at that Striptease Theater.
Wow, this story just keeps on giving. So I'm doing the math here. It's been like almost 4 decades. I'm assuming she's not still doing burlesque dance.
I wouldn't say still, but she just started again.
What?
Yeah, so she took 30 years off, a little bit more than 30 years. She had a day job. She did the books a few places. She wanted to have a job that worked better with her raising her daughter going to school, that worked with those hours.
Her daughter, Cup.
Cup Quake, yes. Cup Quake. And Cup Quake is 40 now. And the way that Michelle got back into dancing was that a few years ago, she got a call from some other artists that dance that wanted to put together a tribute to some of the dancers of the 60s and 70s. Eartha's name came up. They found her and they invited her to these events. And after a 30-year hiatus, she got back into the game.
I was really, really nervous. I mean, I'm not 20 anymore. And, you know, gravity works. but that being said, the body isn't that bad. And it's not about body anymore. It's about performance. It's just like if you go to see a theater production of anything, it's about the performance. And there's all shapes, sizes, whatever. Yeah.
So as you're getting ready for this first initial dance, and I'm sure there was a lot of things going through your
head.
Oh, my
God, yeah.
How are you feeling getting ready? Like you said that, you know, you're not 20 anymore and there's a little bit of the pressure there. When it comes to your age and going back and dancing after this time has passed, what were you afraid of?
What was I afraid of? Missing my music cues, not being able to pop the stuff off right when it should be. Pray to God that my tassels didn't fall off. And I'd been practicing and because I haven't twirled tassels forever. And I was afraid, you know, costume malfunctions, which actually happened the very first time. I went to unzip my dress and it got stuck. Kitty Baby had to come up and help me unzip the dress, but they loved it. You know, it was actually fun. And then actually everything else went good after that.
So when you're back up on stage after all this time and you're doing it, there's a little bit of a costume malfunction, but you're having a good time.
Yes.
Did it feel like it did 30 years ago?
It felt better.
Why did it feel better?
It felt better because I was doing it just to be doing it. I was doing it for fun. I was doing it for a good cause. I wasn't being judged if my waist wasn't 20 inches anymore. Not that it ever was 20 inches, but, you know, they weren't judging my body. There's an awareness that women don't have to be cookie cutter. There's a lot more respect and awareness for older women that just because you're over 50 doesn't mean you don't want to feel sexy and alive and vibrant. I mean, I certainly feel more aware and intelligent now than I did when I was 20, but my personality is not that much different. I'm the same person I was that I, you know, my body's older. My personality is not that much different. And my values and such aren't that much different.
So what do you get from it? What's in it for you?
The applause, the audience, the energy from the audience. And, you know, and I'm probably a bit of an exhibitionist. I mean, you got to be, right? certainly, you know, can I do a back bend like I did when I was young? Of course not. I'd have to have help getting up, you know? But I do other things. And it's just, I think the community is just open and accepting. I think that's what makes it great.
Michelle Mulholland is back in the burlesque game, still performing under the name Eartha Quake, and she talked with Sound Effects senior producer Arwin Nix.
You
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're talking about various aspects of getting older, some of the pleasures, some of the perils. And right now we're here in Seattle Children's Hospital, and over here on the wall there's a mural that looks like it could be out of a children's book. There were pictures of turtles on the floor on the way in. Those little like caution wet floor signs look like banana peels. This looks like a pretty incredible place if you're a little kid. So I'm here with Rose Ibarra, who works in public relations here. And I was wondering, Rose, why would someone come here in their, say, mid-20s?
Seattle Children's years ago recognized that the adolescent, the teen and young adult community of cancer patients really needed specific age-appropriate medical attention and resources to best treat their medical needs as well as their psychosocial needs. And unfortunately, there just hasn't been a lot of that in care centers around the country. And so they opened the first teen and young adult unit to treat cancer patients here that is a better atmosphere for teens and young adults than maybe a typical adult oncology area, but also it's not as childlike as the rest of the hospital.
What's it like up there, and what sort of makes it age appropriate?
So there's little things like there's a little secret cabinet where nurses can push medications through to patients without actually walking in the room and kind of disrupting their privacy. Another little thing is the lighting in the room. They can change the colors of the lighting in the room. They have flat screen TVs in their room. All the artwork and atmosphere there is just a little bit more appealing aesthetically to a young adult with cancer.
How is it different from, say, 10 years ago if a young adult were being treated here at Children's?
Yeah, for one, these are private rooms, so they're not sharing a room with a 5-year-old with cancer, for example. I think also they're surrounded by experts that really understand the psychosocial needs of this population. So there are people that can talk to them about fertility. There are people that can talk to them about dating. They have a weekly pizza night where they can all come out and meet one another so they can connect with other young adults and teens with cancer so that they know that they're not the only one going through it. I think the largest issue that this patient population actually faces is the social isolation.
Rose, do you want to explain why this is something that you know so much about?
Yeah, so 4 years ago when I was 25 years old, I was diagnosed with acute lymphoblastic lymphoma.
What is that variety?
So it's a type of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which is a blood cancer that starts in the lymph nodes. And then later found out that the lymphoma had spread to my spinal fluid as well as my bone marrow. So I was about stage 4 by the time I was diagnosed.
Holy cow.
Yeah. It's, you know, this type of cancer spreads pretty quickly. And, you know, again, it's that issue of delayed diagnosis. Thankfully, I was referred to Seattle Cancer Care Alliance where I got amazing treatment.
So what was going on in your life at the time when you were diagnosed?
You know, I was a reporter at Como News. I wasn't married yet. I was Rose Eggy. I was writing for their website there. I had been dating someone for a few years. I had just bought my first condo, and I felt like I really had life together. Like, I was like, yeah, I got a good job, got this great guy, you know, got a new home. I had just got a cat. Everything was going really well. And then this was a huge curveball for me and dramatically changed the path that my life would go on.
When you were an inpatient, how many other people in their 20s were around you?
Initially, none. I remember the first day of chemo when I still had my hair and I was walking laps around the halls with my pole, running into a couple older men that were probably 50 or above, and they were very sweet and kind and, you know, said, oh, you're going to breeze right through this, you're young, you'll be fine. And that was encouraging, but they couldn't relate as much to what I was going through. As I got further into my treatment, I met some other young people, but it was challenging at first, you know, especially with the world we live in today. We have social networking and everybody's kind of putting their happy, shiny Facebook photos out there. And I remember, you know, sitting in bed at home, being immune compromised and not being able to go out. And all my friends are out at like happy hour and meeting new people and doing all these fun things or having bachelorette parties. And I couldn't be a part of any of it because I was going through something else so entirely different.
One of the other issues with being a young adult is that cancer changes your body in a lot of ways, mostly unwelcome ways. And when you're older, it's just a different calculus, right? When you're a young adult, you've got many, many decades to live with this changed body. So what was that like for you?
You know, that is kind of a scary reality, at least it was for me. once you find out you're cancer-free, it's amazing and it's wonderful. But then you realize, gosh, I need to live 60 or so more years without this cancer coming back and with the damage that the treatment has done to my body. You know, I have osteopenia, and now I'm thinking that I will probably get osteoporosis at a younger age, and there's only so much you can do to keep your bones healthy. Fertility concerns are a big thing. I may go into menopause next year. I don't know.
Wait, explain that. Why would you go into menopause? I mean, you're still, are you 30 yet?
I'm turning 30 in September.
Okay, so you're not even 30. Why are you even thinking about menopause?
Yeah, so one of the ways that, and all cancer treatments affect your fertility differently, but for chemotherapy, and particularly the type of chemotherapy that I had, it speeds up your biological clock. So I actually saw a fertility specialist before I started my cancer treatment, and she described it to me as kind of, you may recover your fertility after treatment, but it might not last as long as it typically would.
So what do you do in that scenario if you think you might want to have children?
You really have to act quickly if you're going to do preservation before treatment. And I was actually able to freeze eggs before starting my treatment, which was great as well because I had a boyfriend that I had for a couple years, but I wasn't really ready to have the conversation with him of like, let's fertilize some embryos and freeze those.
And that option isn't that easy for everybody, right?
My insurance and most insurance won't cover fertility preservation, in particular before you begin cancer treatment, which is really unfortunate fact about insurance. But I was still left with a bill of about $8,000. And admittedly, if my parents hadn't stepped in and been kind enough and generous enough to help me out, I don't know if I could have done it.
And then what happened next?
I had some fertility testing done right away, maybe even too soon, which actually looked not so good. It looked like I was probably going to be infertile, which was really disappointing. But at the same time, I did have the eggs. Still not lovely to hear that you're headed into menopause in your 20s. A year later, I had some symptoms that suggested that maybe my reproductive abilities were coming back, and had testing done again, and my levels looked completely normal. So my doctors encouraged my husband and I to go ahead and try if we were ready, and about 4 months later, we became pregnant.
And where does that bring us to today?
Yeah, so actually today I am 30 weeks pregnant with our son, our first child. And for me, having my body have done something very wrong in allowing cancer to form, and then now it did something right. It's kind of amazing.
Could you say more about that? Because that is such a common thing you hear from people who have had cancer, is that you kind of resent your body, or, you know, it's not on your side. How do you feel about it now?
It was a big issue for me. It continues to be an issue for me. Before I got cancer, I was never really sick. I lived a very healthy, active life. I had a lot of trust in my body. I had that kind of invincible mentality that most young adults have. And then all of a sudden, it felt like my body was kind of self-destructing. If I hadn't done anything, I would absolutely not be here today. And it's something that affects, I think, intimacy and sex and all kinds of issues for young adults and cancer patients of all ages, that you don't trust your body. You resent your body. You're not comfortable with your body. And so now having my body have done something right has kind of helped, I think, with that healing a little bit.
Well, I've been talking with Rosie Barra. She's a public relations specialist at Seattle Children's. She's also a survivor of a cancer diagnosis in her mid-20s. She is the founder of Thrive Through Cancer, a nonprofit that helps young adults with cancer in the Pacific Northwest, and the host and one of the producers of the podcast Voices of Cancer, which explores the stories of cancer patients. Rose, thank you so much for talking to us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Sound Effect is produced by Arwin Nix and Kevin Kniestad. Arwin, I think, gets hazard pay this week for chancing it on the swings.
And I would like to give a special thanks to Jen Guetta, who loves me despite my ridiculous fears.
And special thanks also to Dr. J. Rubenstein of the Dizziness and Balance Center at UW. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. Hey, happy birthday, Aaron, and also to Ed Astaire-Ronco. Let us know what you think of the show. Our email is soundeffect@kplu.org, or you can tweet at KPLU. We podcast on iTunes. You can find us there and write us a review. Come back next week. We're going to be hugging the trees.
Probably over 200 trees.
You had over 200 trees all at once in your 500 square foot apartment?
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.